Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Africa podcast. I'm your host, Andy. In our last episode, we examined the lives of the earliest inhabitants of the Sahara through the art they produced. The transformation of the ancient Sahara from a lively grassland into a harsh desert led the majority of pastoral herding population to flee to its fringes, while a select few remained behind. In this uncertain world, the people of the Fezzan will take a dramatic turn, leading to the earliest advent of the Garamantes civilization. Season 4, Episode 2, Fossil Water Farming. The first millennium BC was a period of immense and uncompromising change in the Fezzan. The Sahara had been rapidly drying for thousands of years, and by this time, had long since come to resemble the seas of sand and rock that it is today. However, while the surface of the Sahara was dry and desolate, in an odd twist, right below it was concealed an enormous supply of the exact resource that the region lacked the most. Over the last millions of years, groundwater had been slowly accumulating into enormous underground aquifers, resulting in the creation of a substantial underground water reserve. Ordinarily, due to its, well, underground location, these aquifers were inaccessible to early Saharans. But on rare occasions, erosions could create natural wells that tapped into these aquifers and brought a small portion of their water to the surface. This resulted in the formation of scattered oases throughout the desert, and it was at these oases where the lifestyle of the Saharans began to shift. Surface water from oases is plentiful, but it is also densely concentrated onto a small surface lake or, well, in some cases, large pond. So, despite their plentiful volume of water lurking before the surface, oases provide very little in terms of arable land, with only the very rim of the oasis being possible to cultivate. This represented a tremendous challenge for the pastoral people of the Sahara. After all, the entire reason for the nomadic nature of pastoralism is that herds tend to devour enormous swaths of plants, meaning that the pastoralists need to keep moving. Otherwise, they'll rapidly exhaust the resources around them, and their herds will starve. However, as arable land grew sparser with every passing generation, this lifestyle became less and less sustainable, with pastoral people having to travel vast distances just for a modicum of feed for their livestock on the rim of an oasis. In order to support themselves, some pastoral groups began to adopt a more opportunistic food economy, occasionally gathering wild-growing dates and edible grasses that grew along the oasis banks. In the late 3rd millennium BC, however, we have the earliest evidence of organized, intentional cultivation of crops in the Sahara. How the practice of true farming emerged in the oasis communities of the ancient Sahara is itself a topic of debate. The most widely accepted theory is that, for the most part, it can be credited to contact with ancient Egypt. For reasons we'll discuss later, we know for a fact that the ancient people of the Fezzan had extensive contact with their neighbors across the desert. It seems plausible that knowledge of agriculture spread through this contact, especially so when you consider that, well, many of the crops cultivated in Fezzan originate from the Middle East and Northeast Africa, indicating that these crops were likely introduced to the Sahara through trade with the Egyptians. However, even if the initial idea of farming may have come from across the desert, the local conditions of Fezzan ensured that the locals would have to make some radical adjustment to Egyptian farming techniques if they were to live. Unlike the Nile, oases don't regularly flood, meaning that Saharan oasis farmers would have to manually inundate and irrigate their own land, typically using pottery to scoop and distribute water onto arable soil. The idea that the people of the Sahara transitioned from pastoralism to farming would also be slightly misleading. Throughout the 3rd and 2nd millennium BC, a growing number of Saharans chose to adopt a settled lifestyle, relying on the cultivation of wheat, millet, figs, and dates, not only to complement a pastoral lifestyle, but to fulfill the bulk of their diet. But even then, there remained a widespread minority who retained this pastoral lifestyle, growing accustomed to long marches through the desert from oasis to oasis. These two parallel societies of settled farmers and nomadic herdsmen would each develop different lifestyles and cultures, but remain integral to each other's lives and influence the other's development significantly. As you might expect, the lifestyle of settled agriculturalists in these oases was radically different from how people had traditionally lived in the Sahara. The archaeology of one oasis town in Fezzan, the Ghat Oasis, can give us some insight into these changes. See, Ghat, like all oasis towns, is plagued by a perpetual severe shortage of arable land. The shortage of arable land necessitated that, in order to survive, the people there would have to use it as efficiently as possible. In Ghat, this need for efficient land use resulted in a division of land into densely packed family compounds. The compounds were all built on the periphery of the oasis, outside of arable land, ensuring that this valuable resource was not wasted by being occupied by housing. Each compound contained multiple round single-room huts, constructed of packed mud, and was surrounded by a small fence. Now, while the transition to agriculture is usually associated with the rise of hierarchy and inequality, archaeological evidence from Ghat suggests that, at least initially, life in the oasis remained shockingly egalitarian. Rather than the emergence of a set social hierarchy, these early oasis settlements were rather heterarchical, meaning that while different people held different roles in society, they were generally afforded the same level of social respect and resource wealth. For example, gravesites in Ghat from the early agricultural period don't show many of the typical signs of inequality. It's not uncommon for people to be buried with trinkets or personal belongings, but rarely do you find people with significantly more elaborate graves or belongings than others. Skeletal remains from the site show differences in musculature, showing that some people may have done more manual labor than others, but evidence of malnutrition is quite rare. The evidence from these gravesites therefore shows that when famine did happen, it happened to everyone. This varies significantly from more hierarchical societies like ancient Egypt, where the remains of kings, priests, and other elite figures showcase significantly better nutrition and little evidence of manual labor due to their luxurious lifestyles. In periods of famine in ancient Egypt, you can't really tell by looking at the bones of kings. Instead, you have to look at the bones of workers. Even in times of famine, the kings of Egypt ate well, and, well, that simply wasn't true in the Saharan oases, at least not yet. The advent of a stable agrarian food supply allowed for population expansion in the Sahara for the first time in generations. But in an area with such limited arable land and water resources, population expansion was a difficult prospect to manage. The lack of arable land meant that there was a hard cap on the amount of food that could potentially be produced by the society, and if a solution wasn't engineered, anything exceeding that cap would result in starvation. Fortunately, the people of the area were able to innovate a solution: the creation of man-made oases through the drilling of desert wells. These wells were typically small and not especially lucrative in terms of water yield, but in a place as dry as Fezzan, any water yield was an incredibly valuable resource. Well settlements, as they were called, emerged typically in fairly close proximity to large oasis settlements, radiating away from the edges of the oasis in an almost fractalesque pattern. And it is one of these radiating well settlements where Garamantian culture and civilization would truly emerge for the first time. If you remember back to our previous episode, we talked about a very important ephemeral stream valley called Wadi al-Ajal, surrounded by seas of sandy dunes to the north and a vast rocky escarpment to the south. Well, the origins of the Garamanti civilization took place on that southern escarpment, on top of a plateau called Zinkekra. Archaeological excavations from Zinkekra indicate that the earliest settlements on the hill likely originated as a series of shelters for traveling pastoral nomads. The oldest layers, dating to around 1200 BC, show little evidence for plant cultivation, but contain deep layers of hardened goat, cow, and horse feces. The spot was likely chosen by nomads due to its defensive and secure location, at the top of a rock formation. Pastoral nomads could rest easy, knowing that it would be difficult for people to sneak up and attack or rob them. In addition to their animals, however, we also know that the pastoral nomads of Fezzan were active as merchants. After all, if you already have to travel from oasis to oasis to feed your herd, it's a pretty easy leap to say that you will also buy and sell some useful wares as a side hustle. Around 1000 BC, though, greater and greater quantities of vegetables and grain began appearing in the floor levels of Sinkekra. Likely due to the settlement's status as a growing center of trade from its long association with pastoral nomads, Sinkekra became a desirable destination to live in. Around 1000 BC, settled agriculturalists moved to the area and began to transform what had been a set of temporary shelters into a more proper town. We can also assume that security, with the town being built at the top of this rocky plateau, similarly played a role in Sinkekra's desirable status as a town. It's clear that raiders and bandits were on the mind of the residents of this town, as within a few hundred years of its settlement, the rocky terrain of Sinkekra would prove not to be sufficient as a defense in its own right, and the residents began to build a wall around the town not long after its growth began. Sinkekra was far from the first agricultural settlement in Fezzan, nor was it the largest. Rather, what made Sinkekra so special were the subtle ways with which it varied from other ancient Fezzani settlements before it. For example, the pottery at Sinkekra is unrecognizable compared to older settlements. One common motif of Sinkekra pottery is the twisted cord texture, in which a piece of wet pottery would have a rope pressed against the clay, creating a unique twisting pattern on the pot's outer surface. The rise of this unique form of pottery in Sinkekra might also be evidence for the settlement's role as an early trade hub. Twisted cord pottery is much closer in resemblance to styles practiced at the same time across the Sahara, in Sahelian West Africa, by another civilization known as the Tichit culture, indicating that this was likely a style that the people of Sinkekra learned from contact with their neighbors to the south and west, transmitted to them through commercial activity. Alongside this West African style of pottery, there was evidence of other artistic crafts at Sinkekra, notably the production of early textiles and other fabrics, leather, and early carpentry. Architecture, too, began to take on new forms in Sinkekra. Initially, the buildings at Sinkekra resembled the simple round huts of other early agricultural settlements. Over time, though, the agricultural forms at Sinkekra became more advanced. This new form of more complex architecture moved away from having one large round surface of packed mud, and instead began to utilize mud packed into bricks, alongside chiseled sandstone, which they used to build multi-room rectangular buildings. Unlike the round huts in older settlements, which were usually roughly equal in size and scale, the size of these new square homes varied significantly. The most common size of a room within these buildings was approximately 10 to 12 square meters in surface area, but some of the larger homes in Sinkekra had rooms more than three times that size. This divergence in the scale of housing is likely very early evidence of emerging inequality among the people of the Fezzan. The growth of Sinkekra is generally heralded as the arrival of a new era in history of the Fezzan, the early or proto-urban period, with the growth of Sinkekra representing the first true city to appear in the region. What makes the city so important, though, is how it became a mold for future settlements. Many of the new elements that emerged at Sinkekra, from its mud brick and sandstone architecture, to its styles of its pottery, to the layout of its buildings as rectangular subdivisions of larger compounds, would become defining motifs of later Garamantes civilization. For this reason, the development of Sinkekra is widely viewed as the true beginning of a unique Garamantian culture. The agrarian settlement at the top of the plateau, through its control of and relationships with nomadic trade routes, was able to spread its influence across multiple growing settlements in the Fezzan. Ironically, though, the expanding influence of Sinkekra would be the likely cause of its downfall as the center of Garamantian culture and politics. One of the main reasons for Sinkekra's success was, of course, its defensive position at the top of a rocky hill. But as the city tightened its control over the surrounding nomadic peoples, this defensive position became increasingly irrelevant and harder to economically justify. This is especially true given that not far beyond the rocky outcrop of Sinkekra lay the far superior farmland of the Wadi al-Ajal, with much more forgiving soil and access to a regular ephemeral stream. Throughout the 600s and 500s BC, the city of Sinkekra was gradually and slowly abandoned in favor of new settlements located at the bottom of the Wadi. One of these new settlements ultimately took on the new mantle of the most influential city in Fezzan. This new city was called Germa, and it is this city with which we derive that name, Garamantes. The gradual movement away from Zinkekra and towards Germa, in addition to being motivated by the changing security situation, was also influenced by some changes in regional trade routes we'll talk about later in the series. But perhaps the most consequential change that came with the movement to Germa would be the permittance to develop the most iconic innovation in Garamantian history, the irrigation system, which would radically alter life in Fezzan to this day. See, the system of drilling fossil water wells, while functional enough, was incredibly inefficient in terms of labor. Each field required dozens or hundreds of buckets of water to irrigate, and each bucket of water needed to be withdrawn individually by the force of human strength alone, assisted only by maybe a simple precursor to the pulley system. Such a system required tremendous amounts of labor for even a modest amount of water. Then, in the 7th century BC, life changed for the people of the Sahara forever, with an event which, at first glance, seems like it should have barely affected them at all. The ancient Persian Empire, from its homeland in modern Iran, had spread across the Middle East, parts of southern Europe, and then eventually into northern Africa. When the Persians conquered Egypt, they brought with them an irrigation technique that they had practiced previously in Iran, a system called the Qanat, or as it would be known in North Africa, the Fulgara. Portions of the country of Iran, just like the Sahara, consist of arid deserts, but deserts with shockingly potent groundwater reserves. Fulgaras utilize the same groundwater reserves as the old wells of the Sahara. However, rather than using human muscle to deliver water to the surface, the Fulgara instead relies on gravity. From the bottom of a shallow valley, a tunnel would be dug into the side of a hill at an incredibly slight incline, until it eventually reaches the base of the water reserve. Water will then slowly trickle down the tunnel, giving the people in the valley access to a plentiful hydrological supply. Following the Persian conquest of Egypt, knowledge of fugaras would similarly trickle slowly into the Sahara, transforming life in the desert forever. Fugaras were a true wonder of ancient engineering, one which gave those relying on them access to previously unthinkable amounts of fresh groundwater. As the technology of the fugara was introduced into North Africa, it quickly spread to the people of Germa and their neighbors, with the oldest fugaras being excavated in the late 6th century BC. While the city of Germa was already surpassing its hilltop neighbor by this point, Germa's location at the bottom of a valley allowed it to take much greater advantage of the new irrigation system, and further cemented its status as the most important city in the Fezzan. In Germa and other valley settlements, the surplus of water from their fugaras allowed the desert to bloom. Tracts of what had previously been unusable arid land were transformed into fertile farms, and for the first time in millennia, large stretches of the Sahara were green again. However, while they are incredibly useful in the long term, there's one element of the introduction of fugaras which is difficult to explain, which is that they are an immensely difficult project to complete. A single fugara took tens of thousands of man-hours to dig out, and even after its completion, it would have to be continuously maintained to prevent it from collapsing from water erosion and gravity. For this reason, shafts that stretched all the way from the bottom of the fugara's tunnel up to the surface would have to be dug out at regular intervals, making a fugara visible on the surface resembling small little man-made holes which almost resembled miniature shield volcanoes. But the biggest question regarding the creation of these fugaras in the Sahara was, how could an isolated city-state have possibly managed to organize enough labor to complete such an enormous project? Not only to hire, but also to feed and water and equip an army of workers long enough for them to drill such an enormous tunnel. And as if that's not enough of a challenge, there's the fact that there is not one or a few fugaras around Germa, but dozens, and these only make up a small portion of the more than 500 fugaras from the Garamantian period peppered throughout the Wadi al-Ajjal. How could mere city-states have managed such an impossibly large task? Well, according to most archaeologists and historians, the sheer scale of these irrigation projects in the Wadi al-Ajjal is the main form of evidence for the idea that Germa was not, in fact, a mere city-state at all. No, in order to command enough labor to complete these monumental projects, Germa had to have been the capital of a larger state. Whether it was a kingdom, empire, federation, or something in between, we honestly have no idea. But there was clearly some type of large polity in the area, if it was capable of recruiting and coordinating labor across multiple population centers. And through the clever exploitation of these fugaras, by the 5th century BC, Germa had arisen not only to become the largest settlement in the Fezzan by far, but also one of the most impressive cities in ancient North Africa. It's also worth noting that that name, Garamantes, is not some retrospective invention by current historians, but rather a term which appears in ancient sources, indicating that writers contemporaneous to Garamantes' civilization thought of the civilization as being centered in the city of Germa. When you consider these writings, it seems likely that Germa was not only likely the most important city in the Fezzan, but also the capital, economically, politically, and culturally, of the entire region. Across the Wadi al-Ajal, the advent of Fugara irrigation initiated the most rapid population growth seen in the Sahara since its desertification. The surplus of water led to a surplus of food, and therefore, a larger pool of people who could devote their labor to other projects. Join us in our next episode as we examine the economy of the early Garamantian state, and how it interacted and traded with its neighbors on both sides of the Sahara. Thank you for listening to the History of Africa podcast. If you like our show, then we would greatly appreciate if you could help support the show and our project of freely available online history education. You can do this by supporting us at patreon.com/historyofafrica, providing us a rating or review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or iTunes, or by sharing the podcast with anyone who you think might enjoy learning about African history. This episode is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon, including Naomi Kanakia, Iofag Bamie, Dimitri, Alexander Travis, BB Milliam, Conrad Schwenke, Johnny Knowles, Godfrey Sebelabie, Pascal Mokocha, Joe Maxwell, Nkechi Nwabudike, Sheunu Rontimain, Kwajo Amankwa, Douglas Harder and Sherry Robinson, Craig Bolton, Samuel Badeau, Ghassan Virgiani, Ni T, Kitty, Tariq Biedelman, Kelvin J. Anoris, and Ellen Fisher, among others. Thank you all for supporting the show. It really, really, really means a lot.